Sea-Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 398, Thursday, April 29th, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, Sea-Realm Vault subscribers. This is the continuation and conclusion of my conversation with Ben Burgess, which began in Sea-Realm Podcast episode number 570, Pathologies of Powerlessness, which I released earlier today. So, I'm going to jabber quite a bit at the end. So, at the beginning, bare bones. Here's the continuation and conclusion of my conversation with Ben Burgess.
They could just log off, right? Is not really taken to be a reason to think that these aren't real harms. But somehow, in cases like this, we're supposed to pretend that human beings are built such that for most of us, you can have like 1,000 people calling you all the most terrible things that you can think of online, and that it won't bother you. Which we all know that.
A comment from some rando can haunt you for years. Like you'll be thinking for years about what I should have said, what I could have said. It's like, oh, I want to go back to that moment. And you know, now I have my riposte at the ready, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and often at times it's particularly bad and damaging if it's from people who you basically regard as being on your side. So you mentioned, earlier when you were doing the bio, you mentioned that I was going to be teaching this class in June at Renegade University. And it's kind of funny because I remember in the Zoom conversation with Thaddeus Russell, we were setting that up.
You know, Thaddeus Russell's been on the Joe Rogan podcast, right? And you're still willing to
and yet, associate with him. I'm still associated with him. So that's a problem.
He's also talked to Curtis Yarvin repeatedly and likes him.
Well, all right. Yeah. Okay.
And he listens to Steve Bannon.
So this is a good time to officially disavow Thaddeus Russell and all of his works. Yeah.
Teach the course.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll still teach the course, but yeah, I'll just start out every,
but
every,
you'll signal, you'll make
every session with a denunciation of him to make sure everybody knows where I stand. I think that, Thaddeus is somebody I obviously, disagree with politically, but I also quite like. But in any case, in this conversation, you know, he was talking about, it's like, okay, so like probably most of the people who, you know, take the course will be sort of, you know, libertarian or libertarian adjacent. That's like most of the student body, you know, so probably spend some time arguing about stuff, but you know, like they probably have fun with that. And then I think I made a comment to him like, well, I don't really tend to get very bothered or by anything that anybody says in arguments with libertarians, and you know, really who I find myself getting mad at, are other leftists. And Thaddeus made what I thought was an insightful comment, which is like, yeah, of course you're not bothered, by what anybody says in an argument with a libertarian. They're not family. You're most bothered by what people say, who you think of as part of your, extended political family, which I think is exactly right. That, you know, that if somebody, that it's a little bit easier to compartmentalize. Not that none of it's going to bother you. I mean, I don't think that's psychologically realistic necessarily, but I think it's gonna sting the most when people you basically see on your side are calling you all of the things that you would least like to be. You know, a terrible, you know, bigoted trash person and a fascist and all of that.
There's an extensive lexicon on the left, you know, very specific terms for people who hold wrong opinions, like true scum. That's not just a generalized insult. That's a very specific charge.
Yeah. True scum refers to people who hold a trans medicalist position, which is
that was Buck Angel's crime.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which says that you're only truly trans if you are like suffering from like clinical dysphoria, and you seek out medical
transition. Put it crudely, if you're a guy who just likes to wear dresses, you're a drag queen or a tranny, you know, but if you actually go and get the operation and have the chop, then you get to be a trans woman.
Yeah, that's the Buck Angel position, which is what's referred to in a lot of these tweets, and of course a lot of this is specific to like really specifically like trans Twitter. You know, I don't think most people, probably even on the broader left, you know, probably the first time they see that, need somebody to explain it to them. And again, I think the remarkable thing about this instance is that nobody actually suggested that Natalie herself holds this position. The sum total of her crime is that there is somebody who holds this view that she disagrees with, but she still admires for other reasons, and isn't going to have nothing to do with from here on onward, which seems like, to sort of speak to the larger point of the book, a incredibly above and beyond everything else that's wrong with this, just as a way of structuring human interaction. It's also incredibly counterproductive to say that if somebody has a bad view, and oftentimes in these contexts, what counts as a bad view can be, you know, chopping these things up pretty finely, maybe not from a perspective of objective morality or whatever, you can argue about that, but certainly from the perspective of the views of the general population, it's chopping things up pretty finely. So, you know, there are like on the trans issue, I think there's been a lot of progress in public opinion in the last few years, but I mean there's still like half of the public that, like, in a sort of just on a sort of baseline way, you know, like thinks that like that sex at birth is it, and everything else is just nonsense. Like that's still a very popular view. I mean, I'd have to look up the exact.
From my perspective, it's not a crazy view.
I understand why people.
It's not an evil view.
Yeah, I understand. I disagree with it. I understand where it comes from. Mm-hmm. But it's a very widespread view. And, you know, I would be, again, I don't have the polling data in front of me, but I would be pretty surprised if that were less than like 40% of the American public. And
including some people who are pretty far left, like Derek Jensen and Lierre Keith, have had, you know, no end of grief for saying that, you know, men who call themselves women shouldn't be able to intrude on all women's spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the spaces things, there are like, I think you really can come up with ambiguities and edge cases, you know, depending on the context. I'm not like, you know, I'm not somebody who could claim to be so up on the ins and outs of some of these debates that I'd want to.
Well, it's super current right now because various states are passing laws saying that, you know, trans women can't participate in women's sports. And that's what, you know, got the left super mad at Joe Rogan was, you know, he's really into mixed martial arts. And there was this one fighter who, you know, grew up a man, grew up with the benefits of all the, you know, the skeletal structure and the testosterone and the muscle density and the hand size of being a man. And then at one point decided he's a woman. So now he's just going to fight women. And, you know, if you watch these fights, it really just looks like a big man beating up women. And Joe Rogan's position was, that's bullshit. You can't do that. That, you know, I think the thing that got him canceled, or, you know, attempted to cancel, you can't cancel Joe Rogan. He said, get out of here. You know, bullshit. You're a man. He's saying that in the context of, in this instance, you have advantages that are just not sportsmanlike or fair, or they just shouldn't be allowed in this competition. But I saw that taken out of context so many times. People would just quote that one line as if to say, this is Joe Rogan's position on trans people, which is a lie. In that context, that is a lie.
Yeah, there are other places, there are other places where he has said, of course, you should use people's, preferred pronouns, you should, not discriminate in this context of that one.
Or more importantly, just to everybody, he says, if you're struggling with something, I got nothing but love for you. That's his position. It's just a generalized compassion for people who are having trouble, no matter what it is. And yet you'll never hear that acknowledged by his critics.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think that you can find, I think that you can find instances of Rogan actually, in some cases, taking on, there's a clip that I've always loved where he's ranting about Trump's child separation policies, and he says, if you don't have a problem with this, you're not on team human. There are instances where he's arguing with Congressman Dan Crenshaw, who's a guest, about healthcare, and I think saying things that that I would regard as coming from the same place. There are also instances of Joe Rogan, saying things that I find ridiculous. I think that he, I would argue that he gives too much credence to conspiracy theories, and also politically, it's a mixed bag, right? Like that he says, it's like where he's going to come down in anything at any given point, is often a bit unpredictable. I mean, on the Fox Fallon thing, I think that.
Oh, that's the MMA fighter.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think that the way that people talk about this on kind of a meta level is often sort of weirdly detached from the way that people argue about it on a concrete level, because I think that the concrete argument that I see is that about whether, okay, if somebody medically transitioned as an adult, had hormone treatments or whatever, does that actually make up for, for these physical advantages, that you're referring to? Or would you have to do it much earlier? And I think hardly anybody that actually seems to, I mean, on Twitter maybe, but like otherwise, right? Like hardly anybody actually seems to hold the position that it should, that there shouldn't be any sort of medical threshold whatsoever for trans women participating in women's sports. I think the actual argument is more about what that threshold should be, and I think that in this case, or like the arguments about some of the women's spaces arguments, I think that, like in some cases, I think it's a relatively easy call. For example, I think that if you're concerned about minimizing the number of people who are raped in prison, I think that the danger of putting trans women in men's prisons is much greater, than the danger that some trans woman is going to be a rapist, put in a woman's prison, but I'll also acknowledge that that there are going to, because there are so many so many things in so many contexts that are separated by sex or gender, that when those two things, sex at birth and gender identity, come apart, you're going to get messy and ambiguous edge cases that people who basically support equal rights and dignity for trans people won't always come down on the same side of those edge cases. And whatever your position is on them, and mostly with some of the messier, more ambiguous cases, my position is that I don't have to have a position on everything, you know, like I think that,
amen to that.
That like there are lots of people who know much more about these issues than I do who can fight about the fine grained details of them. Yeah. But my bigger concern is whatever you think about those details, when you have such a gigantic percentage of the American public who disagrees with you in a much more fundamental way about the basics, I think that excommunicating each other over the edge cases is just a really bad strategy. I don't think that's going to achieve any of the things that you want to achieve. I think that if you think, okay, what are the most sort of important things at stake here, which, by the way, are not primarily going to be about the sort of metaphysics of what you think gender is,
right? But you live in a world where half of your waking hours are spent in a totalitarian environment where all of your civil rights enshrined by government mean nothing because you work for a corporation. And that corporation tells you when to be there, what to do while you're there, and a long list of things that if you do, you're gone.
Yeah.
That's the primary reality of most people's lives. And if you're going to ignore that, to argue with people or try to sabotage people because they have a bad take or, they disagree with you in some very subtle way, you've completely lost the thread.
No, I agree, right? And I think that there are, and I think as part of those larger concerns that you're talking about, sure, if anti-discrimination laws don't include gender identity, so your boss can fire you for being trans, I'm very concerned with that as a civil rights issue. I think if somebody's denied healthcare that they need, I'm very concerned about that because I care a lot about the right to healthcare. Those are the things those are the aspects of it that I'm most concerned with. And so both on that specific issue and on the broader issue that you're talking about what people's lives are like at work, about the way that those economic forces, change our lives. And about the sort of broader struggle to achieve a society where certainly, yes, everybody has equal, civic and legal rights, but also, we've done something about those core economic realities that you're talking about. To do something about that, what you want to do is to think really hard about how you're going to appeal to the maximum number of people. Because there's a really weird contradiction. I used to talk to the late Michael Brooks about this in the views of people who, in some cases, have sort of ultra left views about how to bring about social change. Like in their minds, we're gonna have 1789 or 1917 style, revolution in the streets or something. But at the same time, they are only willing to sort of acknowledge and accept in their cause, 5% of the public that is the most correct in terms of a very long list of views, takes, sensibilities, and values. And it just doesn't seem like these two things can coexist together. If you want people to rally to your cause, so you can build a movement that can do things like organize workplaces and win elections and all of those things that it would take to do anything about that larger reality, what you want is to seem like you are people who care about the right, are focused on the things that deserve to be focused on. Like maybe you have a sense of humor, you're people that any remotely normal person, and I know that there are people who will insist on reading a remotely normal person as some sort of dog whistle, but like all I mean
is must be a racist like Andrew Yang, who's concerned about normal people.
Yeah. All I mean by that is people from whatever background or identity category who are not soaking in the political subculture of the left. That to any remotely normal person, you know, you seem like somebody that they'd want to spend time with. I mean, that sounds trite, but I mean, like if most of the people that you're trying to appeal to would cross the street to avoid having anything to do with you, you are not going to build a movement of the vast majority of society to change that society in the ways that you want.
Right. You've completely abandoned the project of struggle for political power at that point. You're just tweaking your own neurology, doing things that feel good and make you feel, you know, victorious or powerful in some small and really insignificant way. Hey, exactly. I've had you on the line for a long time, and I appreciate that. I would like to ask you to talk for as long as you care to about the topics of fluidity and essentialism.
Sure. So
and it can be short if you need to.
Sure. So to be an essentialist about something is to think that it has a fixed essence over time that makes it that thing. That there are certain, you know, sort of core properties of it that define it in that way. And of course in some contexts, if we're just sort of doing abstract esoteric philosophy, I certainly wouldn't deny that that's the correct, you know, that can be the correct position on some things and at some times, right? That like there are things that have essences. But where essentialism becomes important as a political context is when you start talking about essentialism about things like, for example, race. To be a racial essentialist is to think that there is some sort of well-defined essence that everybody has in common that makes them a white person, a black person, you know, etc. And of course, the classical kind of racial essentialism would be biological essentialism, which is the original form of it, and certainly the form of it that I think you get in the race chapter of, you know, Murray and Herrnstein's The Bell Curve, for example. That, you know, there are a lot of caveats, but that is basically the view that they're defending. But you could also, I think, be a racial essentialist in a cultural way or in other ways. And I know that everything I've said about this so far is super abstract, right? So I'm going to try to bring it down to the concrete manifestation a little bit. And say that oftentimes the way that I would argue that we even use this term race, and I think that I'm going to focus on race and what follows, but I think you could tell a similar story about some other concepts, you know, gender maybe, that we use the word race in a few different ways, and oftentimes I think that gets really confusing because if you say something like race, what are you talking about? There's no such thing. Then the way a lot of people will hear that is that you're denying the existence of racism, which of course is an entirely different thing. I mean, I deny the existence of witches. But I certainly don't deny the existence of witch burning as a historical phenomenon. And the idea that human beings are divided in some biologically meaningful way into races is something that, you know, not to be too much of a vulgar Marxist about it, you know, but I think without airbrushing too many complexities. I think broadly speaking, is some bullshit that was made up to justify slavery and colonialism. And then, of course, at this point, many people would deny that, but they still seem very invested in holding on to race as a explanatory category. And I think that often ends up being a problem in ways that are at least parallel the problems with sort of classical racial, you know, biological essentialism. So a very small example that comes to mind is after the 2020 election was finally called for Joe Biden. It took like 3 weeks or something. I don't remember exactly. Maybe it wasn't that long. It felt like 3 weeks, but however long it took. At that point, I was at my parents' house in East Lansing. Normally my wife and I are in Houghton Lake. And MSNBC was on, which is, you know, not a not something I normally spend a lot of time, you know, watching because it makes me want to gouge my eyes out. But it was on there, and so I watched a few minutes of it. Rachel Maddow was, you know, filling time because, of course, you know, the way that cable news works, you know, once you've actually said what your breaking news item is, then that's kind of it. But you know, really what you should do is just go back to normal programming after that. But of course that would waste the ratings value of breaking news. So yeah, you have to spend the 3 seconds saying the breaking news item and then come up with some way to spend the next 20 minutes talking about it. And so she and some guests, other MSNBC commentators maybe, started talking about Joe Biden's path to the presidency. And she started talking about the South Carolina primary, which is where, of course, Bernie's winning streak was broken, you know, and Biden won his first primary. And she talked about Clyburn's endorsement of Biden to help make that happen. And she started talking about how, you know, how Clyburn like just had his year or two, or had this like this strong sense of what Black voters were thinking, you know, like what they, you know, what they wanted. And as she was talking about it, it struck me as kind of amazing that that Rachel Maddow was speaking as if she believed that there was a Black voter hive mind, that there was this sort of group intelligence that was all thinking the same thoughts at the same time. Which is kind of amazing because, you know, whatever you think about like what the right way is to think about, okay, so should we just be error theorists about race? In other words, should we think of it like phlogiston or something? It's just like an outdated concept that, you know, that doesn't even make sense. Or should we think, well, there's some sense in which it exists. It just exists as a social construct. But whatever you think about that sort of more esoteric question, like, Black voters as a category, right? You know, Black people in the United States consist of people who are divided in all of the same ways that anybody else is. You know,
a non-trivial portion of them voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I think, to be fair, still a very, very low portion, which I think has to do with a lot of the ways that sort of broader trends and partisan alignment, you know, in the last several decades since the Civil Rights Act, but also yes, more of them than in the past voted for Donald Trump. I think if we had a different kind of conservative party in the United States that didn't like culturally brand itself in exactly the way the Republican Party is, I think that number would be way higher. I think a lot of Black people have basically conservative views still vote for Democrats, you know, because of those trends in partisan alignment. And again, the way that the Republican Party kind of culturally brands itself. But certainly, you have Black bosses and you have Black workers, you have Black landlords and you have Black tenants, you have Black protesters and Black mayors who order the police to tear gas, you know, those protesters. And the idea that all of these people share this essence of blackness that that kind of supersedes everything else, and defines you know, who they are politically, as if this category of the population wasn't divided in all of the economic ways, ideological ways, all the other ways that, that any category of the population is divided, is something that I think, I mean, should go without saying. When you say it all out loud, it sounds kind of trivial. Like, yeah, of course, what's your point? But in practice, it seems to me is often not how people talk about this. In fact, it's not how people with extremely progressive inclinations talk about this stuff. And one way I think this comes out is one of the things that I think people are often talking about when they talk about identity politics. That's a phrase that could use very different things, mean very different things in very different contexts. But one thing that I think especially left critics of identity politics mean when they use that phrase is what Matt Brunig calls identitarian deference, which is the idea that that you as a person who doesn't fall into some group should defer to what some oppressed group thinks about subjects pertaining to their oppression. So you should, as a white person, you should defer to what black people think on anything that has to do with race. As a straight person, you should defer to whatever gay people think, you know, about anything that has to do with, you know, with sexual orientation, etc. And I think this is an incredibly popular view. I see it all the time. And one of the things that most strikes me about this is that it only makes sense if you think that there is this sort of hive mind collective view, right, of the oppressed group about the issue, which is just not true in any of these cases. As the
trans people hold a whole spectrum of views, which ones am I supposed to defer to?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Hey, Buck Angel's a trans person. Should I defer to him?
Yeah.
Or should I defer to Natalie? Should I defer to the people who are outraged at Natalie and basically think that she's just the same as Buck Angel? Whole big spectrum there. And so there's an open question there about who you're supposed to defer to, even on more like superficially simple issues than that. So the example that Brunig gives in his essay about identitarian deference is abortion rights. I mean, that's pretty damn central to the ethos of, you know, movements for gender equality. But the idea that, like, and I've heard people say this on several occasions in my life, that, like, you know, men shouldn't even talk about abortion. They don't even need to have opinions about this. You know, they should just sort of, you know, be quiet and listen. But if you look at the actual polling data on how people feel about abortion rights, there is a gender gap. There are more women than men who support abortion rights, but that gender gap isn't nearly as big as you might think.
Yeah, if men just recuse themselves from the conversation, that doesn't settle it.
Yeah, exactly.
The issue is not done.
No. And
acrimonious fights will continue.
The effect of recusing yourself from the conversation is that the only men who would continue to talk about it would be the ones who disagree with you, which seems counterproductive. But
even if all men recuse themselves from that conversation,
even if all men recuse themselves from the conversation, then it would still be a bitterly divisive topic. Mm-hmm. And even if it's, it's certainly, I don't remember the exact number, the exact percentage of women who have pro-life views, but it's certainly north of 40%. And as Brunig points out, it's not inconceivable that some future cultural shift could shift women's views on abortion from 60-40 pro-choice to 60-40 pro-life. That's not like if you can't imagine that, you don't have very much imagination.
Right.
You
know, bigger shifts have occurred.
Yes.
We actually need to wrap it up. We've been on for a good long time, and as these file sizes get bigger, it gets harder to manage them.
Fair enough.
But I very much enjoyed this conversation. I'm going to get the last word here. I mean, normally I could get the last word after you're off the line because it's a podcast, but I'll let you be party to it. You know, we're talking about Joe Rogan early in the conversation, and one of the criticisms that I hear of Joe Rogan is that his political views seem really unmoored because he tends to agree with the person that he's talking to. You and I could have an argument about all kinds of stuff. And yet I brought you on to talk about this book. And so I asked you questions that I knew you could answer basically by rephrasing this book. And I didn't look for some place to have an argument with you about. And Joe Rogan does the exact same thing. You know, he's giving space for his guests to articulate their views, which might include some nodding when he might not be 100%, you know, committed to the idea. It might involve some, you know, paraphrasing of what he's just heard. And it might seem like, yeah, he agrees with people who hold mutually exclusive positions. And, you know, maybe he does. He contains multitudes, as do we all. So that's my final statement. You can rebut it if you wish.
No, I was just thinking about how if the political alignment of the things that we do disagree about were the other way around, the accusation would be that you don't really disagree with me because you had a whole conversation with me, yeah, where you didn't challenge me on any of those topics.
You know, I'm the podcaster. The people who listen to this show, everyone that I put out, they know my views.
Fair enough.
And somebody who's looking to find some out of context gotcha, there's really nothing I can do to insulate myself from that. So,
all right.
And, you know, there's just a sort of basic courtesy, I think, that a podcaster, it's just incumbent upon a podcaster to exercise. And one is to just don't be a dick. You know?
Yeah. I mean, that seems like a good rule. But in any case, thank you for having me on, and for enabling me to say all of the terrible things that I've said and not challenging me. So really appreciate it.
Right on. Thanks, Ben. All righty. That was Ben Burgess. So we're in a dangerous spot. Dangerous for me, not dangerous for you. The dangerous spot is this, that bit of recording, you know, that bit that I held back, it was not on the main CROM podcast, just here behind the paywall in the vault, was 35 minutes. Podcast should be an hour, right? So there's 25 minutes to fill. So here I am talking into a microphone. Here's the danger. I have opinions. I could start to articulate them. They could generate momentum. There could be some emotional emphasis behind them. And suddenly we're on a rant, and it's an hour later. And I know some of you are rubbing your hands together at the thought of it. In Adobe Audition, you create a file before you record it. You name that file before you start recording. The file that I'm making as I speak right now is labeled Not a Rant. I am not here to rant. I could easily rant. I'm not going to. I've resolved not to. Let's put it that way. So a couple things, a couple points, just to reiterate. And this is me just paraphrasing Ben. These are not my points. The sorts of people who take microaggressions seriously, that's an actual thing. The sort of people who say that there is no difference between speech and literal violence. We'll also say, oh, so 1,000 people were mean to you and you had to get off Twitter for a while. No big deal. Cancel culture is not really a thing. On the topics of fluidity and essence, gender is fluid. You could wake up a man and by noon decide you're a woman. Somewhere in the afternoon decide, you're just genderqueer and, you know, the polarities are just nonsense. You're just completely fluid at that point. But somebody who 99 times out of 100 says things which are anodyne and which you can find no fault with, at one point, maybe they're drunk. Maybe they're at a party. Maybe they think you're on your side and they're willing to say something that's uncomfortable, and they say something which makes them vulnerable. They've let the mask slip. They have showed you their real nature, their essence. They are a racist. Charles Murray. He's a white male and a racist. Now, race is a social construct. Doesn't mean anything. Gender? Fluid. He could be she, zer, whatever, you know, 10 minutes from now. That's fine. But the racist part, that's inscribed in stone. He said something that you interpreted as racist. He is a racist forever. No changing it. No escaping it. No reform. No forgiveness. That's the most important part. No forgiveness. He may never be welcomed back into the fold. He is a racist. Getting a little ranty. I grant you. The only other thing I want to point out. Again, this is from Ben's book, and unlike the other two things I just mentioned, we didn't get to this in the conversation. The left is supposed to be focused on structural inequity, systemic injustice, and yet cancel culture is exclusively focused on individual behavior, spotting it, framing it in the worst possible way, and punishing it to the extent of the mob's ability. Why? Capitalist realism. We can't change the structures, right? There's no alternative. That's what it is. It is what it is. You know, capitalism is what it is. The society at large, you can't change it. All you can do is operate within its parameters. And the society at large enshrines individuality. So as leftist critics of the system at large, we just take individuality and the importance of individual speech, individual action, you know, with the same reverence that the founding fathers did when they wrote that every man is endowed by his creator with the, you know, the thing. We're 5 minutes into the remaining 25 minutes. So here's my backup plan to avert the rant. As I mentioned, maybe not here in this second part, but definitely in the main C. Rome part of the conversation, Ben Burgess in this book makes so many references to Mark Fisher's essay, Exiting the Vampire Castle, that he just comes to abbreviate it as VC, which Mark Fisher himself does in the essay, Exiting the Vampire's Castle. Two things. First, there's a podcast, and I get confused as to who alerted me to what. So if you're listening to this and you are the person who directed me to the Conspirituality podcast, where I heard an episode where they interviewed the two people who do the fucking canceled podcast, I apologize. I cannot thank you by name at this time without, you know, diving into my email and doing searches, which would cost me my train of thought. But the podcast, Fucking Canceled, it's by two Canadian leftists who, they have their problems. They're both addicts of one kind or another, and they're both very enthusiastic about the 12-step program, you know, the 12-step approach to overcoming addiction. And they're also very dedicated to resisting cancel culture, which they consider to be a real thing, having participated in it themselves. And if you go to their website, fuckingcanceled.libsyn.com, you'll find this text description. It's fairly short. They write, Fucking Canceled is a podcast with three aims. First, we analyze and critique a phenomenon on the left that we call the Nexus, a synthesis of identitarianism, social media, and cancel culture. Second, we offer emotional, spiritual, and ethical insights into the process of rejecting and exiting the Nexus. Third, we move toward a different vision for the left, grounded in solidarity, freedom, and responsibility. We are leftists who have spent many years inside the Nexus. We have been too afraid to critique it and have suffered the consequences of critiquing it. We know all too well the destructive impact the Nexus has on our communities, our movements, our spiritual, emotional, and mental health, and our capacity to be responsible, ethical actors. We are also recovering addicts who live our lives by a set of spiritual and ethical principles which are starkly at odds with the rules of the Nexus. We offer these principles as a guiding light toward a different left. Fucking Canceled is a podcast for anyone who feels stifled or trapped by the authoritarian, punishing culture that dominates the left. It's a podcast for anyone who is too afraid to say what they really think. It's a podcast for people who have been canceled, who are afraid of getting canceled, who have taken part in the cancellation of others and wondered if it was right. Fucking Canceled is a podcast for leftists who dream of a left grounded in solidarity, freedom, and responsibility, rather than coercion, authoritarianism, and punishment. So their website is fuckingcanceled.libsyn.com. Check it out. And now, because Ben mentioned, you know, escape or exiting the vampire castle so often, I'm just going to read you that essay. I mean, unfortunately, the author is dead. He took his own life. And, you know, he had struggled with depression. It would be a gross oversimplification to say that the backlash that he received from writing this essay in 2013 drove him to suicide. But he did write this essay. He did receive significant backlash from it, and he did take his own life. Okay, I'm reading this from the opendemocracy.net website, but if you just search for Exiting the Vampire Castle, you can find the PDF. You can find it in a number of places. This essay is very easy to find. So the title is Exiting the Vampire Castle. The longer title is We Need to Learn or Relearn How to Build Comradeship and Solidarity Instead of Doing Capital's Work for It by Condemning and Abusing Each Other. This doesn't mean, of course, that we must always agree. On the contrary, we must create conditions where disagreement can take place without fear of exclusion and excommunication. By Mark Fisher, 24 November, 2013. This summer, I seriously considered withdrawing from any involvement in politics. Exhausted through overwork, incapable of productive activity, I found myself drifting through social networks, feeling my depression and exhaustion increasing. Left-wing Twitter can often be a miserable, dispiriting zone. Earlier this year, there was some high-profile Twitter storms in which particular left-identifying figures were called out and condemned. What these figures had said was sometimes objectionable, but nonetheless, the way in which they were personally vilified and hounded left a horrible residue. The stench of bad conscience and witch-hunting moralism. The reason I didn't speak out on any of these incidents, I'm ashamed to say, was fear. The bullies were in another part of the playground. I didn't want to attract their attention to me. The open savagery of these exchanges was accompanied by something more pervasive, and for that reason, perhaps more debilitating, an atmosphere of snarky resentment. The most frequent object of this resentment is Owen Jones. And the attacks on Jones, the person most responsible for raising class consciousness in the UK in the last few years, was one of the reasons I was so dejected. If this is what happens to a left-winger who is actually succeeding in taking the struggle to the center ground of British life, why would anyone want to follow him into the mainstream? Is the only way to avoid this drip feed of abuse to remain in a position of impotent marginality? One of the things that broke me out of this depressive stupor was going to the People's Assembly in Ipswich, near where I live. The People's Assembly had been greeted with the usual sneers and snarks. This was, we were told, a useless stunt in which media leftists, including Jones, were aggrandizing themselves in yet another display of top-down celebrity culture. What actually happened at the assembly in Ipswich was very different to this caricature. The first half of the evening, culminating in a rousing speech by Owen Jones, was certainly led by the top table speakers. But the second half of the meeting saw working-class activists from all over Suffolk talking to each other, supporting one another, sharing experiences and strategies. Far from being another example of hierarchical leftism, the People's Assembly was an example of how the vertical can be combined with the horizontal. Media power and charisma could draw people who hadn't previously been to a political meeting into the room, where they could talk and strategize with seasoned activists. The atmosphere was anti-racist and anti-sexist, but refreshingly free of the paralyzing guilt and suspicion which hangs over left-wing Twitter like an acrid, stifling fog. Then there was Russell Brand. I've long been an admirer of Brand, one of the few big-name comedians on the current scene to come from a working-class background. Over the last few years, there has been a gradual but remorseless and bourgeoisiement of television comedy, with preposterous, ultra-posh nincompoop Michael McIntyre and a dreary drizzle of bland graduate chancers dominating the stage. The day before Brand's now famous interview with Jeremy Paxman was broadcast on Newsnight, I had seen Brand's stand-up show, The Messiah Complex, in Ipswich. The show was definitely pro-immigrant, pro-communist, anti-homophobic, saturated with working-class intelligence and not afraid to show it, and queer in the way that popular culture used to be, i.e. nothing to do with the sour-faced identitarian piety foisted on us by moralizers on the post-structuralist left. Malcolm X, Shea, politics as psychedelic dismantling of existing reality, this was communism as something cool, sexy, proletarian, instead of a finger-wagging sermon. The next night it was clear that Brand's appearance had produced a moment of splitting. For some of us, Brand's forensic takedown of Paxman was intensely moving. Miraculous. I couldn't remember the last time a person from a working-class background had been given the space to so consummately destroy a class superior, using intelligence and reason. This wasn't Johnny Rotten swearing at Bill Grundy, an act of antagonism which confirmed rather than challenged class stereotypes. Brand had outwitted Paxman. And the use of humor was what separated Brand from the dourness of so much leftism. Brand makes people feel good about themselves, whereas the moralizing left specializes in making people feel bad, and it is not happy until their heads are bent in guilt and self-loathing. The moralizing left quickly ensured that the story was not about Brand's extraordinary breach of the bland conventions of mainstream media debate, nor about his claim that revolution was going to happen. This last claim could only be heard by the cloth-eared petite bourgeoisie narcissist left as Brand saying that he wanted to lead the revolution, something that they responded to with typical resentment. I don't need a jumped-up celebrity to lead me. For the moralizers, the dominant story was about Brand's personal conduct, specifically his sexism. In the febrile McCarthyite atmosphere fermented by the moralizing left, remarks that could be construed as sexist mean that Brand is a sexist, which also meant that he is a misogynist, cut and dried, finished, condemned. It is right that Brand, like any of us, should answer for his behavior and the language that he uses, but such questioning should take place in an atmosphere of comradeship and solidarity, and probably not in public in the first instance. Although when Brand was questioned about his sexism by Mehdi Hassan, he displayed exactly the kind of good-humored humility that was entirely lacking in the stony faces of those who judged him. Quote, I don't think I'm sexist, but I remember my grandmother, the loveliest person I've ever known. But she was racist. But I don't think she knew. I don't know if I have some cultural hangover. I know that I have a great love of proletarian linguistics, like Darling and Bird, so if women think I'm sexist, they're in a better position to judge than I am. So I'll work on that. Close quote. Brand's intervention was not a bid for leadership. It was an inspiration, a call to arms. And I, for one, was inspired. Where a few months before I would have stayed silent as the posh left moralizers subjected Brand to their kangaroo courts and character assassinations with evidence, usually gleaned from the right-wing press, always available to lend a hand, this time I was prepared to take them on. The response to Brand quickly became as significant as the Paxman exchange itself. As Laura Oldfield Ford pointed out, this was a clarifying moment. And one of the things that was clarified for me was the way in which, in recent years, so much of the self-styled left has suppressed the question of class. Class consciousness is fragile and fleeting. The petite bourgeoisie, which dominates the academy and the culture industry, has all kinds of subtle deflections and preemptions which prevent the topic even coming up. And then, if it does come up, they make one think it is a terrible impertinence, a breach of etiquette, to raise it. I've been speaking now at left-wing anti-capitalist events for years, but I've rarely talked to or been asked to talk about class in public. But once class has reappeared, it is impossible not to see it everywhere in the response to the Brand affair. Brand was quickly judged and/or questioned by at least three ex-private school people on the left. Others told us that Brand couldn't really be working class because he was a millionaire. It's alarming how many leftists seem to fundamentally agree with the drift behind Paxman's question. What gives this working-class person the authority to speak? It's also alarming, actually distressing, that they seem to think that working-class people should remain in poverty, obscurity, and impotence, lest they lose their authenticity. Someone passed me a post written about Brand on Facebook. I don't know the individual who wrote it, and I wouldn't wish to name them. What's important is that the post was symptomatic of a set of snobbish and condescending attitudes that it is apparently all right to exhibit while still classifying oneself as left-wing. The whole tone was horrifyingly high-handed, as if they were a schoolteacher marking a child's work or a psychiatrist assessing a patient. Brand, apparently, is, quote, clearly extremely unstable, one bad relationship or career knockback away from collapsing back into drug addiction or worse, close quote. Although the person claims that they, quote, really quite like Brand, close quote, it perhaps never occurs to them that one of the reasons that Brand might be unstable is just this sort of patronizing faux transcendent assessment from the left bourgeoisie. There's also a shocking but revealing aside where the individual casually refers to Brand's patchy education and the once wince-inducing vocab slips characteristic of the autodidact, which this individual generously says, quote, I have no problem with at all, close quote. How very good of them. This isn't some colonial bureaucrat writing about his attempts to teach some natives the English language in the 19th century or a Victorian schoolmaster at some private institution describing a scholarship boy. It's a leftist, writing a few weeks ago. Where to go from here? It is first of all necessary to identify the features of the discourses and the desires which have led us to this grim and demoralizing pass, where class has disappeared, but moralism is everywhere, where solidarity is impossible, but guilt and fear are omnipresent. And not because we are terrorized by the right, but because we have allowed bourgeois modes of subjectivity to contaminate our movement. I think there are two libidinal discursive configurations which have brought this situation about. They call themselves left-wing, but, as the Brand episode has made clear, they are in many ways a sign that the left, defined as an agent in a class struggle, has all but disappeared. Inside the Vampire's Castle. And here vampires is V-A-M-P-I-R-E-S apostrophe, so plural possessive. The first configuration is what I came to call the Vampire's Castle. The Vampire's Castle specializes in propagating guilt. It is driven by a priest's desire to excommunicate and condemn, an academic pedant's desire to be the first to be seen to spot a mistake, and a hipster's desire to be one of the in-crowd. The danger in attacking the Vampire's Castle is that it can look as if, and it will do everything it can to reinforce this thought, that one is also attacking the struggles against racism, sexism, heterosexism. But far from being the only legitimate expression of such struggles, the Vampire's Castle is best understood as a bourgeois liberal perversion and appropriation of the energy of these movements. The Vampire's Castle was born the moment when the struggle not to be defined by identitarian categories became the quest to have identities recognized by a bourgeois big other. The privilege I certainly enjoy as a white male consists in part of my not being aware of my ethnicity and my gender, and it is a sobering and revelatory experience to occasionally be made aware of these blind spots. But rather than seeking a world in which everyone achieves freedom from identitarian classification, the Vampire's Castle seeks to corral people back into identity camps, where they are forever defined in terms set by dominant power, crippled by self-consciousness, and isolated by a logic of solipsism which insists that we cannot understand one another unless we belong to the same identity group. I've noticed a fascinating magical inversion projection disavowal mechanism whereby the sheer mention of class is now automatically treated as if that means one is trying to downgrade the importance of race and gender. In fact, the opposite is the case, as the Vampire's Castle uses the ultimately liberal understanding of race and gender to obfuscate class. In all of the absurd and traumatic Twitter storms about privilege earlier this year, it was noticeable that the discussion of class privilege was entirely absent. The task, as ever, remains the articulation of class, gender, and race, but the founding move of the Vampire's Castle is the disarticulation of class from other categories. The problem that the Vampire's Castle was set up to solve is this. How do you hold immense wealth and power while also appearing as a victim, marginal, and oppositional? So the VC has recourse to all the infernal strategies, dark pathologies, and psychological torture instruments Christianity invented and which Nietzsche described in the Genealogy of Morals. This priesthood of bad conscience, this nest of pious guilt mongers, is exactly what Nietzsche predicted when he said that something worse than Christianity was already on the way. Now here it is. The Vampire's Castle feeds on the energy and anxieties and vulnerabilities of young students, but most of all, it lives by converting the suffering of particular groups, the more marginal, the better, into academic capital. The most lauded figures in the Vampire's Castle are those who have spotted a new market in suffering, those who can find a group more oppressed and subjugated than any previously exploited will find themselves promoted through the ranks very quickly. The first law of the Vampire's Castle is individualize and privatize everything. While in theory it claims to be in favor of structural critique, in practice it never focuses on anything except individual behavior. Some of these working class types are not terribly well brought up and can be very rude at times. Remember, condemning individuals is always more important than paying attention to impersonal structures. The actual ruling class propagates ideologies of individualism while tending to act as a class. Many of what we call conspiracies are the ruling class showing class solidarity. The VC, as dupe servants of the ruling class, does the opposite. It pays lip service to solidarity and collectivity while always acting as if the individualist categories imposed by power really hold. Because they are petite bourgeoisie to the core, the members of the Vampire's Castle are intensely competitive, but this is repressed in the passive-aggressive manner typical of the bourgeoisie. What holds them together is not solidarity, but mutual fear. The fear that they will be the next one to be outed, exposed, condemned. The second law of the Vampire's Castle is make thought and action appear very, very difficult. There must be no lightness and certainly no humor. Humor isn't serious by definition, right? Thought is hard work for people with posh voices and furrowed brows. Where there is confidence, introduce skepticism. Say, don't be hasty. We have to think more deeply about this. Remember, having convictions is oppressive and might lead to gulags. The third law of the Vampire's Castle is propagate as much guilt as you can. The more guilt, the better. People must feel bad. It is a sign that they understand the gravity of things. It's okay to be class privileged if you feel guilty about privilege and make others in a subordinate class position to you feel guilty too. You do some good works for the poor too, right? The fourth law of the Vampire's Castle is essentialize. While fluidity of identity, plurality, and multiplicity are always claimed on behalf of the VC members, partly to cover up their own invariably wealthy, privileged, or bourgeois assimilationist background, the enemy is always to be essentialized. Since the desires animating the VC are, in large part, priests' desires to excommunicate and condemn, there has to be a strong distinction between good and evil, with the latter essentialized. Notice the tactics. X has made a remark, has behaved in a particular way. These remarks, this behavior, might be construed as transphobic, sexist, etc. So far, okay. But it's the next move which is the kicker. X then becomes defined as a transphobe, sexist, etc. Their whole identity becomes defined by one ill-judged remark or behavioral slip. Once the VC has mustered its witch hunt, the victim, often from a working-class background and not schooled in the passive-aggressive etiquette of the bourgeoisie, can reliably be goaded into losing their temper, further securing their position as pariah slash latest to be consumed in feeding frenzy. The fifth law of the Vampire's Castle, think like a liberal, because you are one. The VC's work of constantly stoking up reactive outrage consists of endlessly pointing out the screamingly obvious. Capital behaves like capital. It's not very nice. Repressive state apparatuses are repressive. We must protest. Neo-anarchy in the UK. The second libidinal formation is neo-anarchism. By neo-anarchists, I definitely do not mean anarchists or syndicalists involved in actual workplace organizations, such as the Solidarity Foundation. I mean, rather, those who identify as anarchists, but whose involvement in politics extends little beyond student protests and occupations and commenting on Twitter. Like the denizens of the Vampire's Castle, neo-anarchists usually come from a petite bourgeois background, if not from somewhere even more class-privileged. They are also overwhelmingly young, in their 20s or at most their early 30s, and what informs the neo-anarchist position is a narrow historical horizon. Neo-anarchists have experienced nothing but capitalist realism. By the time the neo-anarchists had come to political consciousness, and many of them have come to political consciousness remarkably recently, given the level of bullish swagger they sometimes display, the Labour Party has become a Blairite shell, implementing neoliberalism with a small dose of social justice on the side. But the problem with neo-anarchism is that it unthinkingly reflects this historical moment, rather than offering any escape from it. It forgets, or perhaps is genuinely unaware, of the Labour Party's role in nationalizing major industries and utilities, or founding the National Health Service. Neo-anarchists will assert that, quote, parliamentary politics never changed anything, close quote, or the, quote, Labour Party was always useless, close quote, while attending protests about the NHS or retweeting complaints about the dismantling of what remains of the welfare state. There's a strange implicit rule here. It's okay to protest against what Parliament has done, but it's not all right to enter into Parliament or the mass media to attempt to engineer change from there. Mainstream media is to be disdained, but BBC Question Time is to be watched and moaned about on Twitter. Purism shades into fatalism. Better not to be in any way tainted by the corruption of the mainstream. Better to uselessly resist than to risk getting your hands dirty. It's not surprising, then, that so many neo-anarchists come across as depressed. This depression is no doubt reinforced by the anxieties of postgraduate life, since, like the Vampire's Castle, neo-anarchism has its natural home in universities and is usually propagated by those studying for postgraduate qualifications or those who have recently graduated from such study. What is to be done? Why have these two configurations come to the fore? The first reason is that they have been allowed to prosper by capital because they serve its interests. Capital subdued the organized working class by decomposing class consciousness, vigorously subjugating trade unions while seducing hard-working families into identifying with their own narrowly defined interests instead of the interests of the wider class. But why would capital be concerned about a left that replaces class politics with a moralizing individualism, and that, far from building solidarity, spreads fear and insecurity? The second reason is what Jody Dean has called communicative capitalism. It might have been possible to ignore the Vampire's Castle and the neo-anarchists if it weren't for capitalist cyberspace. The VC's pious moralizing has been a feature of a certain left for many years, but if one wasn't a member of this particular church, its sermons could be avoided. Social media means that this is no longer the case, and there is little protection from the psychic pathologies propagated by these discourses. So what can we do now? First of all, it is imperative to reject identitarianism and to recognize that there are no identities, only desires, interests, and identifications. Part of the importance of the British Cultural Studies Project, as revealed so powerfully and so movingly in John Okomfa's installation, The Unfinished Conversation, currently in Tate Britain, and his film, The Stuart Hall Project, was to have resisted identitarian essentialism. Instead of freezing people into chains of already existing equivalences, the point was to treat any articulation as provisional and plastic. New articulations can always be created. No one is essentially anything. Sadly, the right act on this insight more effectively than the left does. The bourgeois identitarian left knows how to propagate guilt and conduct a witch hunt, but it doesn't know how to make converts. But that, after all, is not the point. The aim is not to popularize a leftist position or to win people over to it, but to remain in a position of elite superiority. And now, with class superiority redoubled by moral superiority, too. How dare you talk? It's we who speak for those who suffer. But the rejection of identitarianism can only be achieved by the reassertion of class. A left that does not have class at its core can only be a liberal pressure group. Class consciousness is always double. It involves a simultaneous knowledge of the way in which class frames and shapes all experience, and a knowledge of the particular position that we occupy in the class structure. It must be remembered that the aim of our struggle is not recognition by the bourgeoisie, not even the destruction of the bourgeoisie itself. It is the class structure, a structure that wounds everyone, even those who materially profit from it, that must be destroyed. The interests of the working class are the interests of all. The interests of the bourgeoisie are the interests of capital, which are the interests of no one. Our struggle must be toward the construction of a new and surprising world, not the preservation of identities shaped and distorted by capital. If this seems like a forbidding and daunting task, it is. But we can start to engage in many prefigurative activities right now. Actually, such activities would go beyond prefiguration. They could start a virtuous cycle, a self-fulfilling prophecy in which bourgeois modes of subjectivity are dismantled and a new universality starts to build itself. We need to learn or relearn how to build comradeship and solidarity instead of doing capital's work for it by condemning and abusing each other. This doesn't mean, of course, that we must always agree. On the contrary, we must create conditions where disagreement can take place without fear of exclusion and excommunication. We need to think very strategically about how to use social media, always remembering that despite the egalitarianism claimed for social media by capital's libidinal engineers, that this is currently an enemy territory dedicated to the reproduction of capital. But this doesn't mean that we can't occupy the terrain and start to use it for the purposes of producing class consciousness. We must break out of the debate set up by communicative capitalism in which capital is endlessly cajoling us to participate. And remember that we are involved in a class struggle. The goal is not to be an activist, but to aid the working class to activate and transform itself. Outside the vampire's castle, anything is possible. All right, so I'm not going to sully that with my own commentary. I'm just going to leave it there. Thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.